Christmas and a Happy New Year. Your loving son, Louis. Later that day, the phone rang at the Zamperinis' house. The caller was a woman from the nearby suburb of San Marino. She said that she'd been listening to a radio when the station had aired an intercepted broadcast of an American prisoner of war speaking on Japanese radio. The broadcast had been scratchy and indistinct, but she was sure that she had heard the name right. The POW she had heard, she said, was Louis. The Zamperinis were shocked and wary. The woman was a stranger, and they were afraid that she was a prankster. Sylvia and Louise asked for her address and drove to her house. The woman told them everything she had heard. Sylvia and Louise thanked her and left. They believed the woman, but they didn't know if they could believe the broadcast itself. It could easily have been faked. "I was thinking, could it be true? Could it be true?" Sylvia recalled. After Sylvia and Louise got home, a Western Union telegram arrived from the Provost Marshal General. It read, "Following enemy propaganda broadcast from Japan has been intercepted." Below were Louis' words, as typed by Moody. The telegram ended with a disclaimer. "Pending further confirmation, this report does not establish his status as a prisoner of war." Messages began pouring in from friends and strangers all over the country, telling the Zamperinis of the broadcast, which had been intercepted and re-aired on several stations. And Louis' uncle, Gildo Dossi, called from Wilmington, Iowa. He had clicked on his radio and heard a voice that he felt certain was that of his nephew. The messages relaying the content of the broadcast were varied, but a common thread ran through several of them, a request that they take care of Louis' guns. Louis had grown up hunting, shooting rabbits in the fields around Torrance and on the Kaweah Indian Reservation, and he was especially careful with his guns. To the Zamperinis, this was the fingerprint, the detail that the Japanese could not have known. Louise and Sylvia dissolved in tears, then began shouting with joy. Pete picked up the phone, dialed Peyton Jordan's number, and shouted three words into the receiver. "Pete, he's alive!" Chapter 26. Madness. The Radio Tokyo men were back at Omori, smiling. What a lovely voice Louis had, what a brilliant job he had done. How about another broadcast? As long as he wrote his own copy, Louis saw no reason to decline. He composed another message to his family, then rode with the producers to Tokyo. When he reached the studio, the producers announced a change of plans. They didn't need the message he'd written. They had one already. They handed Louis a sheet of paper. This is what it said, exactly as written. "Well, believe it or not, I guess I'm one of those lucky guys, or maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm really unlucky. Anyway, here's me, Louis Zamperini, age 27, hometown Los Angeles, California, good old United States of America speaking. What I mean by lucky is that I'm still alive and healthy. Yes, and it's a funny thing. I've heard and also saw with my own eyes that I'm washed up. That is, I was reported to have died in combat. Yes, one of those who died gallantly fighting for the cause. I think the official report went something like this. First Lieutenant Louis S. Zamperini, holder of the National Interscholastic Mile Record, is listed as dead by the War Department. The former University of Southern California miler was reported missing in action in the South Pacific in May 1943. Well, what do you know? Boy, that's rich. Here I am just as alive as I could be. But hell, I'm supposed to be dead. Yeah, and this reminds me of another fellow who's in the same boat as me, or at least he was. Anyway, he told me he was officially reported as killed in action, but in reality was a prisoner of war. After several months, he received a letter from his wife in which she told him that she had married again, since she thought he was dead. Of course, she was astonished to hear that he was safe and held in an internment camp. She, however, consolated him by saying that she was willing to divorce again or marry him once again when he gets home. Boy, I really feel sorry for a fellow like that. And the blame lies with the official who allow such unreliable reports. After all, the least they can do is let their folks back home know just where their boy are. Anyway, that's not my worry, but I hope the folks back home are properly notified of the fact that I am alive and intend to stay alive. It's certainly a sad world when a fellow can't even be allowed to live. I mean, when a fellow is killed off by a so-called official report. How about that? Louis was aghast. He had long wondered why he had been spared from execution on Kwajalein after the 9 Marines had been killed, and why he'd been subjected to the will-weakening torment of Ofuna yet not interrogated, even though everyone else had been. At last the Japanese had made their intentions clear. On Kwajalein, after Louis's execution had been ordered, an officer had persuaded his superiors to keep Louis alive to make him into a propaganda tool. A famous American Olympian, he'd reasoned, would be especially valuable. The Japanese had probably sent Louis to the crucible of Ofuna, then to Omori under the Bird, to make his life in camp unbearable, so he'd be willing to do anything, even betray his country, to escape it. They had hidden him from the world, keeping his name off Red Cross rosters, and waited until his government had publicly declared his death before announcing that he was alive. In doing so, they hoped to embarrass America and undermine American soldiers' faith in their government. Louis refused to read the statement. Still smiling, the producers asked him to join them on a little tour. They brought him to a cafeteria and served him a delicious American-style meal, then took him to a private living area that had beds with mattresses and sheets. If Louis would make the broadcast, the producers said, he could live here, and he'd never have to see Omori again. Finally, Louis was introduced to a group of men, Australians and Americans. These men, the producers said, were helping them make broadcasts. As Louis held out his hand, the propaganda prisoners dropped their eyes to the floor. Their faces said it all. If Louis agreed to make this broadcast, he would be forced into a life as his enemy's propagandist. Louis was taken back to the studio and urged to do the broadcast. He refused. The smiles evaporated. The faces hardened. The producers ordered him to do it. He said no. The producers left the room to meet him private. Louis was alone in the studio. In front of him were several copies of the message that they wanted him to deliver. He slid his hand through a tear in his pocket, snagged a copy, and pulled it into his coat. The producers returned. Okay, one of them said. I think you go to punishment camp. Omori was called a punishment camp, but the producers were clearly referring to some other place. For Louis, any camp had to be better than Omori, because the Bird wouldn't be there. The producers gave him one last chance to change his mind. He did not. Louis was dumped back at Omori. The Bird was waiting for him, glowing with renewed hatred. His beatings resumed with intensified vigor. Maybe Louis was being punished for refusing to make the broadcast, or maybe the producer to whom Louis had appealed for help had told the Bird of Louis's accusations. Louis stood his ground, took his beatings with rebellion boiling in him, and waited to be shipped to punishment camp. And, like all the other POWs, he watched the sky, praying that the promise of that first B-29 would be fulfilled. In the early afternoon on Friday, November 24th, the Tokyo sirens began to howl. From the sky came an immense, shivering sound. The POWs looked up. There, so high that they appeared to be gleaming slits in the sky, were acres and acres of B-29s, 111 of them, flying toward an aircraft factory on the rim of the city. Caught in what would later be called the jet stream, the planes were streaking along at speeds approaching 445 miles per hour, almost 100 miles per hour faster than they were built to fly. The Americans had arrived. It was a cold, clear, sunny day, wrote POW Johann Arthur Johansson, who was at a slave site at the time. The planes were shining like silver in the sunshine against the blue sky overhead. It was a beautiful sight, which lifted our spirit right up to the sky. Men began yelling, "Drop the bombs," and "Happy landings," and "Welcome back." The guards stared up, so awed by the planes, that they didn't seem to hear the men shouting. At Omori, the camp accountant, Yuichi Hato, was standing with a group of POWs. As they watched, a lone Japanese fighter raced toward the planes, then, abruptly, startlingly, flew straight into a bomber, the smaller plane shattering and raining down on Tokyo Bay. The bomber began falling, white smoke twirling from it. A single parachute puffed from its side, and one of the POWs cried, "One safe! Safe!" The English word caught in Hatto's ear. He had heard it used only in baseball games. The bomber hit the water, killing all aboard. The lone survivor, under his parachute, wafted over Tokyo as gently as a dandelion seed. As the man sank into the city, Hatto had a sick feeling, thinking of what would happen to that airman when he reached the ground. The other bombers flew on. A few minutes later, there was distant booming. As the fall stretched on, B-29s crossed over Omori nearly every day, sometimes a lone plane, sometimes vast continents of aircraft. On sunny days, the men stood out and watched them. On cloudy days, they only heard them, a growl above the gray. In Tokyo, the sirens sang so incessantly that the POWs began sleeping through them. 81 bombers went over on November 27th. On the drizzly night of November 29th to 30th, the prisoners were awakened by two incendiary raids on Tokyo's industrial areas. Explosions were heard far away, and the POWs could see licks of fire on the mainland, the last gasps of the 2,773 structures that burned that night. Civilians began streaming over the bridge and camping outside Omori's walls in hopes of escaping the bombs. One day, that fall, Louis stood outside watching Japanese fighters turning lupine circles around a crowd of B-29s. The battle was so high that only the giant, shining bombers were consistently visible. The fighters, tiny in contrast, flickered in and out of view as the sunlight caught them. Every little while, there was a sharp, brief burst of light alongside the bombers. To Louis, it looked like firecrackers. It was the fighters, gunned by the B-29s, blowing up. The bombers flew on, imperious. The bird watched the scene with a stricken face. "Hikoki, dame," he said. "Hikoki, dame." Japan's planes, he was lamenting, were no good. Every B-29 that beat a path over Tokyo wound the bird tighter. He hounded the POWs with endless inspections, prohibited smoking, singing, and card playing, and outlawed religious services. He slapped one officer across the face repeatedly for 5 minutes, made him stand at attention, coatless, for 4 hours in the cold, then ordered him to clean the benjos for 2 hours a day for 2 weeks. He beat a kitchen worker with a spoon the size of an oar. He pawed through the men's belongings, confiscating personal papers and photographs of loved ones, deeming much of it suspicious and destroying it. He was seized with paranoia. "You win war, and you make all Japanese like black slaves," he shouted at a POW. He hauled Martindale to his office, accused him of plotting to burn down a barracks, and beat him so energetically with fists and a kendo stick that he overturned all of the furniture. In December, the bird left camp for several days, and Omori was briefly peaceful. But on the night before the bird was slated to return, the POWs were jarred from their sleep to hear him charging through camp in a driving rainstorm, yelling that it was a fire drill. When the designated firefighters assembled under the freezing downpour, the bird punched several of them in the face, ran through barracks shouting and punching other men, then ordered every man in camp to line up outside. When Louis and the others did as told, the bird drew his sword, swung it around, and screamed orders and invectives. For 2 hours, the bird forced the men to pump water on imaginary fires, beat out phantom blazes with brooms, and run in and out of buildings, rescuing food and documents. As December progressed, the bird's mania deepened. He rounded up the officers and hounded them across the bridge and into Tokyo on the pretense of retrieving firewood from bombed-out houses. Troughs of water for firefighting had been set along the streets, and as the men marched, the bird leapt upon one, drew his sword, and screamed, "Kirei!" The men saluted him, and the bird, lost in a fantasy, stood on his roost in an absurdly exaggerated troop-reviewing pose that reminded Tom Wade of Mussolini. Civilians gathered and began cheering. After the POWs had passed, the bird jumped down, ran ahead, and hopped onto another trough, shouting, striking his pose, and demanding salutes. Over and over he repeated the farce, driving the men on for miles. When the bombs were falling, the bird would snap, running through camp with his sword in the air, wailing at the men, foam flying from his mouth, lips peeled back in a wicked rictus, eyelid drooping, face purple. During at least two bombings, he prevented the POWs from seeking cover in the trenches. In one incident, he ran the POWs outside, stood them at attention, and ordered the guards to aim their rifles at them. With bombs booming, the bird raced up and down the line of terrified POWs, swinging his sword over their heads. Every escalation in the bombing brought a parallel escalation in the bird's attacks on Louis. He sped around the camp in search of the American, fuming and furious. Louis hid, but the bird always found him. 3 or 4 times a week, the bird launched himself at Louis in what Frank Tinker would call his death lunge, coming at him with fists flying, going for his face and head. Louis would emerge dazed and bleeding. He was more and more convinced that Watanabe wouldn't stop until he was dead. Louis began to come apart. At night, the bird stalked his dreams, screeching, seething, his belt buckle flying at Louis's skull. In the dreams, the smothered rage in Louis would overwhelm him, and he'd find himself on top of his monster, his hands on the corporal's neck, strangling the life from him. As Louis suffered through December, some 300 miles away, his former pilot was wasting away in a filthy, unheated barracks in the Zensuji POW camp. Phil had been transferred to Zensuji the previous August, joining one-legged Fred Garrett, who'd been transferred from Ofuna. Though Ofuna interrogators had spoken of Zensuji as a plush reward, the camp was no such place. The prisoners' diet was so poor that the men wandered the compound ravenous, pulling up weeds and eating them. Their only drinking water came from a reservoir fed by runoff from rice paddies fertilized with human excrement, and to avoid dying of thirst, the POWs had to drink it, leaving 90% of them afflicted with dysentery. In one barracks room, men lost an average of 54 pounds over 18 months. An officer estimated that 20 men fainted each day. Almost everyone had beriberi, and some men went blind from malnutrition. On the last day of November, they buried an American who had starved to death. There was one blessing at Zensuji. Phil was permitted to send brief messages home on postcards. He wrote one after another. They were mailed, but got snarled in the postal system. The fall waned and another Christmas approached, and Phil's family received none of them. A year and a half had passed since Phil had disappeared. His family remained in limbo, having heard nothing about him since his plane had gone down. In November, they had learned about Louis's broadcast. The news had been tantalizing, but frustrating. Louis had mentioned other servicemen who were with him, but the names had been obscured by static, and the transcript hadn't conveyed them with certainty. Had Louis mentioned Alan? On a Friday night in December 1944, the telephone rang in Kelsey Phillips' home. On the line was a major from the Adjutant General's office at the War Department. Probably through the Red Cross, the department had received news from Zensuji. Alan was alive. Kelsey was jubilant. She asked the major to cable her husband and her son's fiancé, and in Washington, Cece got the news she had awaited for so long. The fortune teller had said that Alan would be found before Christmas. It was December 8th. Overcome with elation, Cece called her brother to shout the news, quit her job, dashed through her apartment throwing clothes and pictures of Alan into a suitcase, and hopped a plane back to Indiana to wait for her fiancé to come home. 4 days before Christmas, a card from Alan, written in October, finally reached home. Dear folk, hope you are all well, and I'm looking forward to being home with you. I hope we can go rabbit hunting before the season closes, Dad. Give my love to Cece, Martha, and Dick. Happy birthday, Dad. Kelsey pored over the precious slip of paper, comforted by the familiar lines of her son's handwriting. Chaplain Phillips, now stationed in France, got the news on Christmas Eve. Words really cannot describe the way I feel, he wrote to his daughter. I am in an altogether new world now. I can think of nothing more wonderful. It is a real touch of all that heaven means. In a letter officially confirming that Alan was a POW, the Phillipses were asked not to speak publicly about the fact that Alan had been discovered alive. Kelsey would henceforth heed this request, but the letter had reached her too late. By the morning after the War Department's call, the news was already all over town, and stories about Alan's survival were in the local papers. The Zamperinis, who had received a similar letter stating that the War Department now believed that Louis' broadcast had been real, were also asked not to speak of it publicly. The War Department probably didn't want it known that they had erroneously declared two airmen dead, especially as the Japanese were exploiting this fact. Kelsey was allowed to send one cable to her son, and she filled the other days writing letters to him. On December 14th, she wrote to Louise Zamperini. As relieved as Kelsey was for Alan, there was heaviness in her heart. Of all the men on Green Hornet, only Louis and Alan had been found. Hugh Cuppernell's mother was so demoralized that she could no longer bear to write to the other mothers. Sadie Glassman, mother of the belly gunner, Frank Glassman, had written to Louise asking if she had heard anything about Frank. "Even though we have heard nothing," she wrote, "the fact that you might know something makes us feel as though there might be a little hope. It is difficult to rejoice outwardly, though I do in my heart, when I think of the other mothers whom I have learned to love and realize how keenly they feel the loss that is theirs," Kelsey wrote to Louise. "How my heart goes out to them, and I shall write them, every one." As Christmas neared, Louis faltered. Starvation was consuming him. The occasional gifts from the thieves helped, but not enough. What was most maddening was that ample food was so near. Twice that fall, Red Cross relief packages had been delivered for the POWs, but instead of distributing them, camp officials had hauled them into storage and begun taking what they wanted from them. They made no effort to hide the stealing. We could see them throwing away unmistakable wrappers, carrying bowls of bulk cocoa and sugar between huts, and even trying to wash clothes with cakes of American cheese, wrote Tom Wade. The bird was the worst offender, smoking Lucky Strike cigarettes and openly keeping Red Cross food in his room. From one delivery of 240 Red Cross boxes, the bird stole 48, more than 500 pounds of goods. Toward the end of December, the bird ordered all of the men to the compound, where they found a truck brimming with apples and oranges. In all of his time as a POW, Louis had seen only one piece of fruit, the tangerine that Sasaki had given him. The men were told that they could take two pieces each. As the famished men swarmed onto the pile, Japanese photographers circled, snapping photos. Then, just as the men were ready to devour the fruit, the order came to put it all back. The entire thing had been staged for propaganda. On Christmas Eve, some Red Cross packages were finally handed out. Louis wrote triumphantly of it in his diary. His box, weighing some 11 pounds, contained corned beef, cheese, pâté, salmon, butter, jam, chocolate, milk, prunes, and four packs of Chesterfields. All evening long, the men of Omori traded goods, smoked, and gorged themselves. That night, there was another treat, and it came about as the result of a series of curious events. Among the POWs was a chronically unwashed, ingenious, and possibly insane kleptomaniac named Mansfield. Shortly before Christmas, Mansfield broke into the storehouse, slipping past seven guards, and made off with several Red Cross packages, which he buried under his barracks. Discovering his cache, guards locked him in a cell. Mansfield broke out, stole 16 more parcels, and snuck them back into his cell. He hid the contents of the packages in a secret compartment he'd fashioned himself, marking the door with a message for other POWs: "Food, help yourself, lift here." Caught again, he was tied to a tree in the snow without food or water, wearing only pajamas, and beaten. By one account, he was left there for 10 days. Late one night, when Louis was walking back from the Benjo, he saw the camp interpreter, Yukichi Kano, kneeling beside Mansfield, draping a blanket over him. The next morning, the blanket was gone, retrieved before the bird could see it. Eventually, Mansfield was untied and taken to a civilian prison, where he flourished. The one good consequence of this event was that in the storehouse, Mansfield had discovered a Red Cross theatrical trunk. He told other POWs about it, and this gave the men the idea of boosting morale by staging a Christmas play. They secured the bird's approval by stroking his ego, naming him Master of Ceremonies, and giving him a throne at the front of the theater, the bathhouse, outfitted with planks perched on washtubs to serve as a stage. the men decided to put on a musical production of Cinderella, written, with creative liberties, by a British POW. Frank Tinker put his operatic gifts to work as Prince Leander of Pantoland. The fairy godmother was played by a mountainous Cockney Brit dressed in a tutu and tights. Characters included Lady Diarrhea and Lady Gonorrhea. Louis thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. Private Cano translated for the guards, who sat in the back laughing and clapping. The bird gloried in the limelight, and for that night he let Louis and the others be. At Zen Suji, Christmas came to Phil and Fred Garrett. Some POWs scrounged up musical instruments and assembled in the camp. Before 700 starving men, they played rousing music as the men sang along. They ended with the national anthems of England, Holland, and the United States. The Sensuji POWs stood together at attention in silence, thinking of home. After Christmas, the bird abruptly stopped attacking the POWs, even Louis. He paced about camp, brooding. The men watched him and wondered what was going on. Several times that year, a dignitary named Prince Yoshitomo Tokugawa had come to camp. A prominent and influential man, reportedly a descendant of the first shogun, Tokugawa was touring camps for the Japanese Red Cross. At Omori, he met with POW Louis Bush, who told him about the bird's cruelty. The bird was suspicious. After Tokugawa first visited, the bird forbade Bush from speaking to him again. When the prince returned, Bush defied the bird, who beat him savagely as soon as the prince left. Tokugawa kept coming, and Bush kept meeting with him. The bird slugged and kicked Bush, but Bush refused to be cowed. Deeply troubled by what he heard, Tokugawa went to the War Office and the Red Cross and pushed to have something done about Watanabe. He told Bush that he was encountering resistance. Then, just before the new year, the prince at last succeeded. The bird was ordered to leave Omori. Tokugawa's victory was a hollow one. Officials made no effort to take the bird out of contact with POWs. They simply ordered his transfer to a distant, isolated camp, where he'd have exactly the same sway over prisoners, without the prying eyes of the prince and the Red Cross. Ensuring that no censure of Watanabe was implied, Colonel Sakaba promoted him to sergeant. The bird threw himself a goodbye party and ordered some of the POW officers to come. The officers dashed around camp to gather stool samples from the greenest dysentery patients, mixed up a ferocious gravy, and slathered it over a stack of rice cakes. When they arrived at the party, they presented the cakes to the bird as a token of their affection. While the men lavished the bird with lamentations on how they'd miss him, the bird ate heartily. He seemed heartbroken to be leaving. Later that day, Louis looked out of the barracks and saw the bird standing by the gate in a group of people shaking hands. All of the POWs were in a state of high animation. Louis asked what was happening, and someone told him that the bird was leaving for good. Louis felt almost out of his head with joy. If the rice cakes performed as engineered, they didn't do so quickly. The bird crossed the bridge onto the mainland looking perfectly well. At Omori, the reign of terror was over. Chapter 27 Falling Down. At Omori, life became immeasurably better. Private Kano quietly took over the camp, working with Watanabe's replacement, Sergeant Oguri, a humane, fair-minded man. The bird's rules were abolished. Someone got into the bird's office and found a pile of mail sent to the POWs by their families. Some of the letters had been in his office for 9 months. The letters were delivered, and the POWs were finally allowed to write home. "Trust you're all in good health and in the highest of spirits, not the kind that comes in bottles," Louis wrote in one letter to his family. "Tell Pete," he wrote in another, "that when I'm 50, I'll have more hair on my head than he had at 20. The letters, like so many others, languished in the glacial mail system and wouldn't make it to America until long after the war's end. 2 weeks into 1945, a group of men, tattered and bent, trudged over the bamboo bridge and into Omori. Louis knew their faces. These were Ofuna men. Commander Fitzgerald was with them. The Omori prisoners told him that he was the luckiest man in Japan. A vicious tyrant called the Bird had just left. Among the new POWs, Louis spotted Bill Harris, and his heart fell. Harris was a wreck. When Louis greeted him, his old friend looked at him vaguely. He was hazy and distant, his mind struggling for purchase on his thoughts. The beating the quack had delivered to Harris in September 1944 hadn't been the last. On November 6th, apparently after Harris was caught speaking, the quack had pounced on him again, joining several guards and clubbing him into unconsciousness. 2 months later, Harris had been beaten once more for stealing nails to repair his torn shoes, which he was trying to nurse through a frigid winter. He had asked the Japanese to give him some, but they had refused. The Omori POW doctor examined Harris gravely. He told Louis that he thought the Marine was dying. That same day, Oguri opened the storehouse and had the Red Cross boxes handed out. Giving his box to Harris was, Louis would say, the hardest and easiest thing he ever did. Harris rallied. Since his refusal to become a propaganda prisoner, Louis had been waiting to be shipped to punishment camp. While the Bird had badgered him, he had awaited his fate with equanimity. Now that the Bird was gone, and Harris was here with Louis's other friends, Louis wanted to stay. He met every day with dread, awaiting his transfer. The B-29s kept coming. Sirens sounded several times a day. Rumors eddied around camp. Manila had been captured. Germany had fallen. The Americans were about to charge the Japanese beaches. Louis, like a lot of POWs, was worried. Frightened by the bombing, the guards were increasingly jumpy and angry. Even guards who had once been amiable were now hostile, lashing out without reason. As the assaults on Japan intensified and the probability of invasion rose, the Japanese seemed to view the POWs as threatening. Among the American forces, a horrifying piece of news had just surfaced. 150 American POWs had long been held on Palawan Island in the Philippines, where they'd been used as slaves to construct an airfield. In December, after American planes bombed the field, the POWs were ordered to dig shelters. They were told to build the entrances only one man wide. On December 14th, an American convoy was spotted near Palawan. The commander of the Japanese 2nd Air Division was apparently sure that the Americans intended to invade. It was the scenario for which the kill-all order had been written. That night, the commander sent a radio message to Palawan. Annihilate the 150 prisoners. On December 15th, on Palawan, the guards suddenly began screaming that there were enemy planes coming. The POWs crawled into the shelters and sat there, hearing no planes. Then liquid began to rain onto them. It was gasoline. The guards tossed in torches, then hand grenades. The shelters and the men inside erupted in flames. As the guards cheered, the POWs fought to escape, some clawing their own fingertips off. Nearly all of those who broke out were bayoneted, machine-gunned, or beaten to death. Only 11 men escaped. They swam across a nearby bay and were discovered by inmates at a penal colony. The inmates delivered them to Filipino guerrillas, who brought them to American forces. That night, the Japanese threw a party to celebrate the massacre. Their anticipation of an American landing turned out to be mistaken. Sleet was falling over Omori as February 16th dawned. At 7:15, Louis and the other POWs had just finished a breakfast of barley and soup when the sirens piped up. Commander Fitzgerald looked at his friends. He knew that this would probably not be B-29s, which would have had to fly all night to reach Japan so early. It was probably carrier aircraft. His navy must be near. A few seconds later, the room was shaking. The men bolted for the doors. Louis ran out into a crashing, tumbling world. The entire sky was swarming with hundreds of fighters, American and Japanese, rising and falling, streaming bullets at one another. Over Tokyo, lines of dive bombers bellied down like waves slapping a beach, slamming bombs into the aircraft works and airport. As they rose, quills of fire came up under them. Louis was standing directly underneath the largest air battle yet fought over Japan. The guards fixed their bayonets and ordered the POWs back inside. Louis and the others filed into the barracks, waited for the guards to rush off to censure someone else, then stole out. They ran behind a barracks, climbed the camp fence, and hung there, resting their elbows on the top. The view was electrifying. Planes were sweeping over every corner of the sky, and all around, fighters were dropping into the water. One dogfight riveted Louis's attention. An American Hellcat hooked up with a Japanese fighter and began chasing it. The Japanese fighter turned toward the city and dove low over the bay, the Hellcat right behind it. The two planes streaked past the camp, the Japanese fighter racing flat out, the Hellcat's guns firing. Several hundred POWs watched from the camp fence, their eyes pressed to knot holes, or their heads poking over the top, hearts leaping, ears roaring. The fighters were so close that Louis could see both pilots' faces. The Japanese fighter crossed over the coast, and the Hellcat broke away. All told, 1,500 American planes and several hundred Japanese planes flew over the POWs that day. That night, the city was bathed in red fires. The following day, back the planes came. By the end of February 17th, more than 500 Japanese planes, both on the ground and in the air, had been lost, and Japan's aircraft works had been badly hit. The Americans had lost 80 planes. 7 days later, the hammer fell. At 7 in the morning, during a heavy snowstorm, 1,600 carrier-based planes flew past Omori and bombed Tokyo. Then came B-29s, 229 of them, carrying incendiary bombs. Encountering almost no resistance, they sped for the industrial district and let their bombs fall. The POWs could see fire dancing over the skyline. On the last day of February, Louis and the other officers were called into the compound. 15 names were called, among them Zamperini, Wade, Tinker, Meade, and Fitzgerald. They were told that they were being transferred to a camp called 4B, also known as Naoetsu. Louis greeted the news with bright spirits. Wherever he was going, he would be joined by almost all of his friends. On the evening of March 1st, the chosen men gathered their belongings and donned overcoats that had been distributed the day before. Louis said goodbye to Harris. He would never see him again. The Naoetsu-bound men climbed aboard a truck which bore them into Tokyo. Watching the air battle over the city had been exhilarating, but when the men saw the consequences, they were shocked. Whole neighborhoods had been reduced to charred ruins, row after row of homes, now nothing but black bones. In the rubble, Louis noticed something shining. Standing in the remains of many houses were large industrial machines. What Louis was seeing was a small fragment of a giant cottage industry. War production, farmed out to innumerable private homes, schools, and small shadow factories. Louis and the other transferring POWs were driven to the railway station and put on a train. They rode all night, moving west into a snowy landscape. As they rode on, the snow became deeper and deeper. At about 9 a.m. on March 2nd, the train drew up to Naoetsu, a seaside village on the west coast of Japan. Led to the front of the station, the POWs stared in amazement. The snow rose up some 14 feet overhead. Climbing up a stairway cut into the drifts, they found themselves in a blindingly white world, standing atop a snow mountain that buried the entire village. It was as if a giant frosted cake were sitting in the town, Wade wrote. The snow was so deep that residents had dug vertical tunnels to get in and out of their homes. The contrast to fire black in Tokyo was jarring. Pulling their baggage along on sleighs, the POWs began the mile and a quarter walk to camp. It was windy and bitterly cold. Fitzgerald, who had a badly infected foot, had the most difficulty. His crutches poked deep in the snow and wouldn't hold his weight. The prisoners crossed a bridge and saw the Sea of Japan. Just short of it, cornered against the Ara and Hokura rivers, was the Naoetsu POW camp, almost entirely obscured by snow. Louis and the others trudged into the compound and stopped before a shack, where they were told to stand to attention. They waited for some time, the wind frisking their clothes. At last, a door thumped open. A man rushed out and snapped to a halt, screaming, "Kire!" It was the bird. Louis's legs folded. The snow reared up at him, and down he went. Chapter 28. Enslaved. Louis would remember the moment when he saw the bird as the darkest of his life. For the bird, it was something else. He beamed like a child on his birthday. He seemed certain that the POWs were overjoyed to see him. Fitzgerald forked forward on his crutches and assumed the duties of senior POW. The bird announced that, just as at Omori, he was in command and that the men must obey. He said that he would make this camp just as Omori had been under his tenure. Ringing with shock, Louis picked himself up and hiked through the snow to the barracks, a two-story building on the edge of a small cliff that dropped straight down to the frozen Hokura River. The 300 residents, mostly Australians, were shrunken down to virtual stick figures. Most were wearing the tropical weight khakis in which they'd been captured, and which, thanks to years of uninterrupted wear, were so ragged that one civilian likened them to seaweed. The wind, scudding off the sea, whistled through cracks in the walls, and there were so many holes in the roof that it snowed indoors. The whole building was visibly infested with fleas and lice, and rats trotted through the rooms. The beds were planks nailed into the walls. The mattresses were loose rice straw. Everywhere there were large gaps in the floor. The POWs had pulled up the floorboards and burned them in an effort to survive temperatures that regularly plunged far below zero. Stacked against one wall were dozens of small boxes, some of which had broken open and spilled gray ash onto the floor. These were the cremated remains of 60 Australian POWs, one in every five prisoners, who had died in this camp in 1943 and 1944, succumbing to pneumonia, beriberi, malnutrition, colitis, or a combination of these. Relentless physical abuse had precipitated most of the deaths. In a POW camp network that would resonate across history as a supreme example of cruelty, Nawetsu had won a special place as one of the blackest holes in the Japanese Empire. Of the many hells that Louis had known in this war, this place would be the worst. Louis lay on his plank and tried to ready himself for what Nawetsu would bring. As he fell asleep that night, halfway around the globe, the world's best runners were gathering for a track meet at Madison Square Garden. The promoters had renamed the marquee event in tribute to Louis, who was still believed dead by virtually everyone outside of his family. When the Zamperinis heard of it, they were upset. The race was to be called the Louis S. Zamperini Memorial Mile. Out of respect for the family, the name was changed to the Louis S. Zamperini Invitational, but that did little to lift the spirits of those involved. Marty Glickman, who'd been on the 1936 Olympic team with Louis, watched the race with tears streaming down his face. The race was won by Jim Rafferty, America's best miler. His time was 4 minutes 16.4 seconds. 4 seconds slower than the time Louis had clocked on the sand of Oahu just before climbing aboard Green Hornet. The first weeks Louis spent at Nawetsu were almost lethally cold. Each night of shivering in his bed of straw ended abruptly before dawn, when he was shouted awake and forced outside for Tenko in deep snow, howling wind, and darkness. By day, he huddled with Tinker, Wade, and his other friends in patches of sunlight, trying in vain to keep warm. He was soon nursing a cough, fever, and flu-like symptoms, and the Nawetsu slop did nothing to help his body recover. The rations, which were halved for officers, rarely varied from millet or barley and boiled seaweed, plus a few slices of vegetable. The drinking water, which the POWs had to haul in on sleds, was yellow and reeked. Seeing the guard smoking American cigarettes, the POWs knew that the Red Cross was sending relief packages, but the prisoners got nothing. Watanabe was the same fiend that he'd been at Omori, prompting the Aussies to nickname him Wada Bastard. He held a far lower rank than Nawetsu's commander, an elfin man sporting an abbreviated mustache as an apparent homage to Hitler, but the commander deferred to the bird, just as the officers at Omori had done. and here the bird had recruited a henchman, an eggplant-shaped man named Hiroaki Kono, who trailed Watanabe around camp, assaulting men with the intensity, wrote Wade, of a roaring Hitlerian animal. Louis's transfer to Naoetsu, into the grip of the bird, had been no coincidence. Watanabe had handpicked him and the others to come to this camp, which was short on officers. According to Wade, each chosen man had a skill or history that would make him useful. Al Meade, who had helped save Louis from starvation at Ofuna, had headed Omori's cookhouse. Fitzgerald had been a ranking officer. Wade had been a barracks commander, and so on. The only man with no such history was Louis. Wade believed that the bird had chosen Louis simply because he wanted to torment him. Wade was right. From almost the moment that Louis walked into camp, the bird was on him, slapping him, punching him, and berating him. Other POWs were shocked at how the sergeant pursued Louis, attacking him, remembered one POW, just for drill. Louis took his beatings with as much defiance as ever, provoking the bird to ever more violent attacks. Once again, in his tormentor's clutches, Louis descended back into a state of profound stress. And yet, by virtue of his rank, Louis was fortunate. Naoetsu was a factory village that generated products critical to the war effort, and all of its young workers had gone to war. The POWs were here to take their place. Each day, the enlisted POWs waded through the snow to labor in a steel mill, a chemical factory, the port's coal and salt barges, or a site at which they broke rocks for mineral extraction. The work was extraordinarily arduous and often dangerous, and shifts went on day and night, some for 18 hours. In the hikes back from this slave labor, men were so rubber-legged that they tumbled into snow crevasses and had to be dragged out. Each morning and night, Louis saw the enlisted men rambling in from their slave shifts, some completely obscured by coal soot, some so exhausted that they had to be carried into the barracks. The Japanese literally worked men to death at Naoetsu. Louis had much to bear, but at least he didn't have this. Winter faded. The river ice gave way to flowing water, and houses emerged where only snow had been. When the drifts in the compound melted, a pig miraculously appeared. All winter he'd been living below the POWs in a snow cavern, sustained by bits of food dropped to him by an Australian. Louis looked at him in wonder. The animal's skin had gone translucent. With the ground thawed, the bird announced that he was sending the officers to work as farm laborers. Though this violated the Geneva Convention's prohibition on forcing officers to labor, Fitzgerald now knew what life in camp with the bird was like. Work on the farm would keep the officers out of the bird's path for hours every day, and couldn't be anything like the back-breaking labor done by the enlisted men. Fitzgerald raised no protest. Each morning, Louis and the rest of the farming party assembled before the barracks, attended by a civilian guard named Ogawa. They loaded a cart with benjo waste, to be used as fertilizer, as was customary in Japan, then yoked themselves to the cart like oxen and pulled it to and from the farm. As they picked their way along the road, sometimes darting off to try to steal a vegetable from a field while Ogawa's back was turned, Japanese farmers came out to stare at them, probably the first Westerners they'd ever seen. Louis looked back at the wan, stooped old men and women. The hardships of this war were evident on their blank, weary faces and from their bodies, winnowed for want of food. A few children scampered about, raising their arms in imitation of surrender and mocking the prisoners. There were no young adults. The walk, 6 miles each way, was a tiring slog, but the work, planting and tending potatoes, was relatively easy. Ogawa was a placid man, and though he carried a club, he never used it. The plot had a clean well, a relief after the stinking camp water, and Ogawa let the men drink all they wished. And because they were now working outside the camp, the officers were granted full rations. Though those rations were dwindling as Japan's fortunes fell, a full bowl of seaweed was better than half a bowl of seaweed. April 13th was a bright day, the land bathed in sunshine, the sky wide and clear. Louis and the other officers were scattered over the potato plot, working, when the field suddenly went still, and the men turned their faces to the sky. At the same moment, all over Naoetsu, labor at the outdoor work sites halted as the POWs and guards gazed up. High overhead, something was winking in the sunlight, slender ribbons of white unfurling behind it. It was a B-29. It was the first superfortress to cross over Naoetsu. The Omori officers had seen hundreds of B-29s over Tokyo, but for the Australians, who'd been hidden in this village since 1942, this was their first glimpse of the bomber. Followed by innumerable eyes, some hopeful and some horrified, the B-29 made a slow arc from one horizon to the other, following the coastline. No guns shot at it, no fighters chased it. It dropped no bombs, passing peacefully overhead, but its appearance was a telling sign of how far over Japan the Americans were now venturing, and how little resistance the Japanese could offer. As all of Naoetsu watched, the plane slid out of view, and its contrails dissolved behind it. The POWs were elated. The Japanese were unnerved. At the work sites, the prisoners hid their excitement behind neutral faces to avoid provoking the guards, who were unusually tense and hostile. On the walk back to camp that evening, the prisoners absorbed a few swipes with the club, but their mood remained merry. When they reached the gate, the bird was waiting for them. Roosevelt, he said, was dead. The men deflated. The bird sent them into the barracks. A few days later, Ogawa made a little joke to the bird, teasing him about how his POW officers were lazy. Ogawa meant no harm, but the remark sent the bird into a fury. He shouted for the farm workers to line up before him, then began berating them for their indolence. He stormed and frothed, seeming completely deranged. Finally, he screamed his punishment. From now on, all officers would perform hard labor, loading coal on barges. If they refused, he would execute every one of them. One look at the bird told Fitzgerald that this was an order he could not fight. Early the next morning, as the officers were marched off to labor, the bird stood by watching them go. He was smiling. It was a short walk into slavery. The officers were taken to the riverbank and crowded onto a barge, which was heaped with coal destined for the steel mill. Six men were given shovels. Louis and the rest were given large baskets and told to strap them to their backs. Then, on the guards' orders, the shovelers began heaving coal into each man's basket. As a cubic foot of loose coal can weigh as much as 60 pounds, the bearers were soon staggering. Once the baskets were full, the bearers were ordered to lug the loads off the barge and up the shore to a railroad car, where they wobbled up a narrow, steep ramp, dumped the coal into the car, and returned to have their baskets refilled. All day, the men shoveled and hauled. The guards kept the basket men moving at a rapid clip. By the time the guards finally let them stop, the men were utterly exhausted. By Wade's estimate, over the course of the day, each basket bearer had carried well over 4 tons of coal. So began a daily routine. Each time the men finished clearing one barge, they were pushed aboard another, and the hauling went on, punishing their bodies and numbing their minds. Somewhere along the way, as he and the others bent under their burdens and plodded along, Tom Wade began reciting poetry and speeches. Louis and the other slaves shoveled and walked in time with Shakespeare's soliloquies, with Churchill's vow to fight in the fields and in the streets and in the hills, with Lincoln's last full measure of devotion. The barges were eventually empty, but the officers' life in slavery had only just begun. In a mass of POWs, Louis was herded onto another of the barges, which was pulled by a tugboat into the Sea of Japan. About 3/4 of a mile out, the barge drew alongside an anchored coal ship and stopped, the sea heaving under it, water spraying over the deck. Standing before the prisoners, a guard gestured to a net slung over the side of the ship. "Jump from the barge onto the net," he said, "then climb up onto the ship's deck." The POWs were appalled. On the tossing sea, the two vessels were pitching up and down, crashing together and rolling apart, and the net was a rapidly moving target. If the men mistimed their jumps, they'd be caught between the crafts as they collided or thrown into the water as they gapped apart. The men balked, but the guards forced them forward, and the POWs began jumping. Louis, as scared as everyone else, sprang across and climbed clear. He was hustled into the ship's hold. Before him stood a giant dome of coal, and beside it a large hanging net. As he was given a shovel, the guards suddenly teamed around him, screaming at him to get to work. Louis jammed his shovel into the coal and began piling it into the net. Hour after hour, Louis stooped over his shovel in a churning cloud of black dust. The guards turned circles around him and the others, shouting and cracking them with clubs and kendo sticks. They pushed the POWs at such a frenzied pace that the laborers never had a moment to straighten their backs. Clubbed and badgered, Louis shoveled so frantically that the men alongside him whispered to him to slow down. At last, in the evening, the work was halted. The POWs were taken back to shore and dropped there, so caked in coal that they were virtually indistinguishable. Every morning, the men were sent back to take up their shovels again. Every night, they dragged back into camp a long line of blackened ghosts, trudging into the barracks and falling onto their bunks, weary to their bones, spitting black saliva. There was just one bathtub in camp, and its water was almost never changed. The one other place to bathe was a vat at the steel mill, but the guards marched the POWs there for baths only once every 10 days. Unwilling to brave the camp tub, the coal labor men lived in a patina of soot, waiting to go to the mill. Eventually, Wade felt so befouled that he had someone shave the coal-clotted hair from his head. It was an act of expiation, he wrote. Day after day, Louis shoveled. Occasionally, he was switched from coal to industrial salt. The work was just as taxing, and the salt liquefied in his sweat and ran down his back, burning fissures in his skin. Fitzgerald labored alongside his men and tangled with the foremen to protect them. Once, during a nonstop 14-hour shift, he ordered the POWs to stop and told the foreman that he wouldn't let his men work until they were fed. After much argument, the overseers brought the men a single huge ball of rice, then sent them back to work. Tragedy was inevitable, and Louis was there when it happened. He was standing on the barge, awaiting his turn to jump to the ship, when the man ahead of him mistimed his leap, thudding into the side of the ship just as it collided with the barge. Crushed between the vessels, the man crumpled onto the barge. The guards hardly paused, pushing Louis to make his jump. While the rest of the POWs tramped past him, the injured man was left where he lay. Louis never learned if he survived. The slave labor at Nauetsu was the kind of work that swallowed men's souls. But the prisoners found ways to score little victories, so essential to their physical and emotional survival. Most of the work sites offered nothing to sabotage, but stealing was epidemic. On the barges, men would wait until the operator stepped away, then sprint into the galley and stuff all the food they could find into their clothes. The lunch boxes of the civilian guards kept vanishing. An overseer's pack of cigarettes, set down while he turned away, would be gone when he turned back. The POWs would pinch anything they could, often items they had no need for, risking a beating or worse for something as useless as a pencil box. The box itself was nothing. The theft of it was everything. Because the POW diet was severely deficient in sodium, leaving many men crippled by muscle cramps and other ailments, the men developed a system for stealing and processing salt. As they worked, the men on the salt barges would secrete handfuls of salt in their pockets. In its raw form, the salt was inedible, so the bargemen would carry it up to camp and slip it to the POWs assigned to the steel mill. These men would hide the salt in their clothing and carry it to the mill, wait until the guard wasn't looking, then drop lumps of it into canteens filled with water. At day's end, they'd hang the canteens on the side of a coal fire vat. By morning, the water would be boiled away, leaving only edible salt residue, a treasure beyond price. While in the Benjo one day, Louis looked through a knothole and noticed that a grain sack was resting against it, in a storage room on the other side of the wall. Remembering the thieving techniques of the Scots at Omori, he left the Benjo, searched the camp, and found a pile of discarded bamboo reeds, which were hollow. He took one, and when the guards weren't watching, sharpened the end. That night, he put on his cab-issued pajamas, which were fitted with strings.